Welcome to the Accelerators Podcast. We are radiation oncologists Matt Spraker, Simmel Parikh, and Anna Brown, and we're bringing you news and views with guests from all over the field. The discussions on this show are not medical advice, and they represent our own opinions and not those of our employers. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Okay, so yeah, over the last year or so, we've been treating arthritis patients with low-dose radiation. We're trying to figure out new indications for radiation for benign treatments, non-cancerous use. Have you done any of that, or have you guys talked about it in residency at all?
So we've talked about the arthritis data for sure. It's really exciting. I mean, if you think about the arthritis population, that's a vast population. If we had even a toehold in management of arthritis, I think we can all be employed for a long, long time to come. What I do have some experience from clinically and in a research capacity is functional radiosurgery for benign indications. Actually did a paper on radiosurgical alone treatment of high-KUS grade acoustic neuromas. I treated a 13.5 centimeter KUS grade 4 acoustic neuromas compressing the brainstem, causing midline shift with a fractionated course of gamma knife. The guy did really, really well. It was important that he wasn't presenting with symptoms that required an immediate surgical decompression, because that would have been another story. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting because this is one of the extreme examples, I think, of somewhere where we have good data on clinical outcomes, even though it's not used very much. It's been going on a long time. Radiosurgery can be effective for treating everything from obsessive compulsive disorder to intractable non-malignant pain to trigeminal neuralgia, obviously, depression, anxiety, things like that. I don't think anybody knows exactly why, because the pathways aren't very well charted, but apparently if you ablate the anterior limb of the internal capsule bilaterally, people who have suffered with psychiatric conditions that are not responsive to any kind of medical intervention can end up doing pretty well. And again, you know, how many people suffer depression, anxiety? It's a large number.
By the way, this is Simmel Parikh, host of the Accelerators. I'm medical director at Lake Huron Medical Center, and I'm here with a really interesting guest who will introduce himself.
Hi there. I'm Dan Koffler. I'm an attending radiation oncologist. Just recently finished residency. This is my first attending position, and I'm at Mayo Clinic, Florida.
Awesome. So there are so many things we can do with radiation, but just because we're a radiation oncologist doesn't mean we only have to use radiation. And there's other treatments we can do in general for our patients. And we had a conversation earlier about this. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the things that you've been talking about discussing with your patients?
Yeah. So, you know, this is something where I just kind of noticed that there were unmet clinical needs that were really kind of falling through the cracks with all of the hyper-specialization that we see in pain medicine and palliative medicine and different branches of oncology. There are certain things that are just not addressed very well. One of them being the various forms of mental and physical distress that accompany a cancer diagnosis. There is a whole body of research that's been growing into various psychoactive psychedelic agents that shows a lot of promise, both again for physical and for mental indications. And I think those things are more intimately connected than we tend to be taught, and we can get into that a little bit.
Yeah. So that's the thing. Like, I mean, half of our care is palliative in nature, and mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be just palliative radiation and opioids. There's more right. that we can do for our patients. So I love this because anxiety and depression come hand in hand with a life-altering or life-threatening diagnosis. What are some of the things that people have been looking at in the past to treat these symptoms? And also anxiety of death, because that's something that I don't even have cancer and I have that.
Part kind of the human condition there. Yeah. So I'll tell you about how I got interested in this. In training, I was at a place that just had a very large volume of head and neck cancer patients. And head and neck is a setting that's not really a palliative setting. It's a curative setting. It's one where if we can get people through from beginning to end of treatment, even in locally advanced disease, we can see very good oncological outcomes. But the catch there is they have to get from beginning to end of treatment. And we were noticing, as you would expect, as anybody who's observed some of the toxicities associated with chemo radiation for head and neck cancer, that we had really high rates of premature treatment terminations and treatment breaks. The head and neck setting was in our institution, it was second to vulvar cancer in absolute percentage of treatment terminations and made up by far the highest contribution to our treatment terminations of something like 35% over, I think it was a 2017 to 2020 period, something like that. You know, these patients would, they'd get prescribed, you know, normal regimen of oxycodone, et cetera. And it was rad oncs who were giving it. We're comfortable prescribing oxycodone. And then when people are not doing great on that, they'll get referred over to our pain management clinic. And we had some very good, pain medicine doctors, some of whom were also boarded in medical oncology, and they understood our patients, and they'd have more sophisticated approaches to giving opioids, than we would. Than we're trained in, but even so, it was an opioid-based regimen basically that was used.
So I've been using a lot of, you know, opioids over the last 13 years of practicing. I mean, we treat head and neck, we treat other areas of the body, and you know, they tend to help. They tend to stay on them for quite a long time. And as we know, long-term opioid use has its own problems. The last 20 years have taught us that. Yet we very easily write these prescriptions without thinking too much about it, or at least in my experience and my partners, we've seen it very commonly used. And it's sort of the only tool in the toolbox. I mean, there's the mouthwash studies. There are a couple other things that we have for mucositis, but and the like gabapentin type of medications. But it is very unrewarding using these medicines for these patients.
Right. And I was going to mention that, too. I think, you know, there is a recognition that opioids are a double-edged sword. And so, you know, typically the regimen's rounded out with magic mouthwash, with gabapentin, pregabalin, what have you. I think the evidence for that is pretty mixed. Some people do okay with it. A lot of people don't really get much relief from it. And as far as the magic mouthwash, you know, it's good for letting somebody have enough relief to swallow successfully for a while and get some nutrition in. But it, you know, it obviously doesn't last very long. And so somebody who's in a state of more or less round the clock pain to the point where they can't even sleep because they're in so much pain, you know, magic mouthwash is not a solution for them. And as you say, and the other thing, you know, the other thing with opioids, and the chronic use of opioids is that there's a very well attested opioid tolerance effect. It has to do with exhaustion of the receptors. Normally there's a recycling that goes on through a MAP-ERK mediated pathway, where receptors are undergo endocytosis, get refreshed, but constant exposure to opioids kind of arrests that process. That's on a physiological, pathophysiological level, what's happening. So it just occurred to me that there has to be a better answer than this, right? And so that's when I started getting into the weeds of pain medicine research, anesthesia research. And the thing that I came upon as a very promising agent is ketamine. You know, ketamine's a drug that's been around since the early 60s. It's on the World Health Organization list of essential medications. If you look at things like combat battlefield anesthesia, it's the thing that's used because it's the only drug that in and of itself can induce all four domains of anesthesia, which are analgesia, amnesia, sedation, relaxation. Any other way of inducing anesthesia is going to require a combination of different drugs. And ketamine also doesn't cause respiratory arrest, which is pretty significant. You know, there have been some randomized trials of systemic ketamine administration for cancer pain, and they've typically had good results. There are, I think, five overall high quality RCTs that have been done. Four of them have shown a reduction in pain or reduction in opioid use. And one was kind of poorly designed, but there is a problem with systemic ketamine administration, obviously, which is it can have psychoactive effects.
So the psychoactive effects can be concerning to physicians and patients. And yet, you know, for some investigators and some researchers, that's part of the treatment process. So can you speak about that a little bit?
Well, yeah. So, and I think we'll get into this a little bit more when we talk about some of the ways of dealing with mental distress. But for people who are in physical pain, you know, they don't necessarily want to have a mind-altering experience of any kind. So, what you will find if you dig far enough into the literature is that there's a fair amount of research into topical preparations of ketamine, ketamine ointments, ketamine creams, ketamine as an augmentative agent in interventional procedures, like as an additive to steroid epidural injections, and even one study on ketamine mouthwash for chemotherapy-associated oral mucositis. And that was kind of what inspired me. So I wrote and started a phase 2 trial, got an FDA IND for it. We're still in the process. I don't have any data to report yet, but we are using ketamine mouthwash to try to alleviate the toxicities of head and neck chemo radiation.
So when it's applied topically or mucosal surfaces, are patients going to experience any sort of mind-altering effects?
Yeah, that's the crucial question, and the answer is there are reams of data about this. This has been very well studied, and so there's a certain threshold serum level of ketamine that you need to get to have that mind-altering experience, and very consistently across every topical route of administration, the answer is no. The levels you get to are negligible. So local topical ketamine administration is very, very safe in terms of inducing a psychoactive response.
So before we get to some of the studies that have been published and then some of the exciting things you're working on, when we talked earlier, you told me about a few patient experiences in the clinic. And I'd love for you to go over that because I found that to be super interesting.
So here's the thing. The other advantage of ketamine, and this relates to other psychedelic discussions as well. Unlike all of the others, ketamine is a Schedule III drug. Like I said, it's on the list of essential medications. Anybody who's licensed to practice medicine and surgery can write a prescription for ketamine. And there are high quality FDA regulated compounding pharmacies that will provide customized ketamine preparations for you. So some of my early experiences included a patient who had recently completed treatment for vulvar cancer, which as listeners I'm sure know is a rough course of treatment. Toxicity is really high. Mucositis can be exquisitely painful. And this is a patient who's already through treatment, through to the end, but she was having residual pain that just was not subsiding. Opioids were not doing anything for her. She had been given a number of different topical creams and things, not really helping either. There's also some discharge involved and some bleeding. And I was able to find a way to get her a topical preparation of ketamine. She used it daily through external application for a couple weeks, and things resolved for her. She did really, really well.
So that's amazing. I mean, like that goes back to the head and neck. I mean, we're talking about compliance and finishing the course of treatment. And, you know, as we know, occasionally these patients, even young, fit patients, are so frustrated with the toxicity of treatment, with the change in their taste and their pain and everything that's going along with it. We know that for many squamous cell cancers, that prolongation of treatment, you know, overall treatment time matters. So it sounds like this could be something that actually not only reduces symptoms, but can improve chances of cure.
I mean, absolutely. You know, there are a number of disease sites where we have, you know, really well-established research showing that the prolongation of treatment, let alone early curtailment of treatment, not getting to the full therapeutic dose, is going to be associated with a decrement in control and ultimately a decrement in survival. So there are oncological implications to the mismanagement or undermanagement of pain and other kinds of discomfort in this setting. So absolutely, you know, and I'm sure anybody who's been in practice and treated head and neck patients, they can see the kind of mental anguish that this engenders also, that, you know, you're in your third or fourth week and things are starting to get rough and you've got all these weeks ahead of you. And each day is an ordeal. You're struggling to eat. You're struggling to maintain weight. Swallowing is a crisis in and of itself. And it can seem just like an impossible marathon to run. So if a local intervention with minimal toxicity can be the difference between having just enough comfort in that in that interval to get to the end of treatment successfully, then yeah, we may be in a position to look back in years and say, we actually got people who would otherwise probably have seen recurrence and what comes with recurrence, who were able to be successfully cured.
That's amazing. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the past studies and some of the things that you've seen in the literature about ketamine in oncology patients?
Yeah. So it's a quite rich literature. So I started by mentioning systemic ketamine studies. In terms of the topical ketamine studies, swabs of ketamine solution were given to pediatric patients in an RCT to control post tonsillectomy pain. That was successful. Combinations of ketamine spray with morphine and lidocaine have also been used following oral surgeries, and people have done very well with that. Topical ketamine cream has been used to treat postherpetic neuralgia, diabetic neuropathy, chemotherapy-induced neuropathy, and pelvic pain. There was a meta-analysis of, I think, 34 studies, which included 13 RCTs, and that consistently found across the board statistically significant reductions in pain. And again, I should say basically zero reported side effects, and the plasma levels of ketamine were measured in a number of those studies and found to be negligible.
Wow. Okay, continue. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. So I was going to say, in terms of the direct inspiration, that it was a small pilot phase two study of ketamine in mouthwash form for people with oral mucositis associated with chemotherapy. And they saw reductions in pain, improvement in sleep quality, which I think is a very important quality of life measure, and a trend towards less opioid use. The other thing that I want to say about this is, you know, this is a patient population that is on the brink frequently of nutritional collapse. Lots of feeding tube placements in RTOG 1016, if I'm remembering the numbers right, something like 60% of patients at treatment end in the winning arm, in the cisplatin arm, needed some kind of feeding tube intervention, which is a huge number. So simply by controlling pain enough to get people to be able to tolerate oral nutrition, in and of itself makes a potentially significant difference to their quality of life, and again to their survival prospects by not having that interruption in treatment associated with the feeding tube placement.
Okay. Is there any other ongoing studies currently? And then I did want to talk about your your foray into this world.
There was one similar study similar to ours that's looking at ketamine mouthwash. I think it's for radiotherapy alone patients. It's listed on clinicaltrials.gov. I'd have to dig up the details of it. It's a smaller study than ours. I think ours is designed in a way that may be more able to capture a signal. And this is because our primary endpoint, we didn't decide between pain and opioid use as being the one primary endpoint. We basically cribbed an MD Anderson scale that combines them into a single metric. The reason being because both of these things are important, right? The part of that opioid tolerance effect that we were discussing is that as people need a higher and higher dose of opioids to reach the same level of pain control, they're going to have an additive effect to their toxicities, which include the bowel toxicities of opioids. And of course, again, in a patient population that's nutritionally compromised to begin with, throwing on severe constipation on top of all that can be a devastating thing. That's the difference. Those are the two studies that are ongoing, as I know.
Yeah. So that's something we talked about earlier, is that pain medicine doesn't necessarily stop working, but you need more of it. And then you're getting all the bad side effects, because those you don't build a tolerance to.
Right.
Unfortunately.
And this is the thing that on the level of the basic science is so fascinating about ketamine. To my knowledge, this is a unique pharmacologic property. So I had mentioned earlier, it's this MAP-ERK-mediated pathway that's responsible for opioid receptor recycling and refreshment, et cetera. And ketamine's mechanism of action, acting on the NMDA receptor as an antagonist, blockades the phosphorylation of ERK 1 and 2. And as a result of that, the opioid-induced desensitization is essentially aborted, or can be aborted for a lot of people, so that they're able to maintain a single stable dose of opioids to get the same analgesic benefit from it. So you're at 10 morphine equivalents day one, you're on 10 morphine equivalents at day 30, and you haven't had to go up on your dose. And that in and of itself can be very significant, because again, you don't have the addition of all the extra side effects from that escalating dose of opioids just to get to the same benefit for pain control.
That's awesome. I mean, that's the thing that I'm seeing is like, I feel like we should be done with the medication a month after treatment. And I got these guys, these poor guys, they're still suffering. And I try to wean them off. And then, you know, a week later, you get that phone call like, doc, I'm hurting still. And you got to bring them in again. And their mouth looks pretty good. You know, it looks like it's all cleared up. And yet there's some pain sensation that I know is real. Like after some years, you get a sense of who may be pain medication seeking versus someone who just has uncontrolled pain that we're not managing very well. And it does get us stuck. And the end of the line for me is like when I reach a certain dose and a certain number of pills, I transition then to pain medicine. Mm-hmm. I'm in a small town in Michigan, about 50 miles from Detroit. I can tell you it's very hard to get a pain medicine consultation for a cancer patient. What we have is pain medicine doctors locally that are handling workman's comp, and they're handling car accidents, and they're handling a different type of pain medication and a different type of support that's needed for oncology. And I think that's where where RadOncs, with our palliative training, if not formalized but informally learned over the course of training and practice, that we're perfectly suited to help with non-opioid pain management.
And I think, yeah, for sure. And, you know, I've been lucky that I've been able to work with pain medicine doctors who are double boarded in medical oncology. That is not something that is going to be an expectation that a lot of people can hope to find, certainly not in community practice. Just having somebody who's a good pain doctor, that you're able to access, who's nearby, who can see a consultation quickly. That's even that much is pretty lucky. You know, given that we know more about cancer, we should be taking a role in the management of the needs of cancer patients. The way I'd put it is this: if you're comfortable writing an oxycodone prescription, you should be familiar enough with the pharmacology of drugs like ketamine, and comfortable enough to write the prescription that if somebody needs it, you can do it. Now, I think it's really important when we look at these novel and unconventional ways of approaching pain and management of other forms of distress that we do it in, you know, very carefully and well-designed clinical trials to really be able to measure outcomes in a robust way. But people can do things right now. I'll give you another example from my experience. There was a patient who had a really unfortunate constellation of a malignancy of GI origin. The primary site couldn't be identified, but histologically GI, and simultaneously had mets to the brain and mets to the vaginal canal, the latter of which was causing exquisite pain. I mean, really exquisite pain, to the point where just, you know, moving around, anything where she had to move her pelvis was setting her off, and bleeding also that had to be controlled. And so, you know, we were going to pursue a course of palliative radiation for that, to control the bleeding, to control the pain. But as we know, radiation in the short term exacerbates inflammation. And for somebody who is in that much pain to begin with, I didn't know if she'd be able to even tolerate 5 days of palliative radiation for that. So before we started, I was able to procure a course of vaginal ketamine suppositories for her. And again, she did really well. And anybody who's got a license to practice medicine can do this right now.
And to reiterate, she did not get any mind-altering effects.
Nothing whatsoever.
Nothing. See, that? I mean, that's the thing. Like, I think many people, including myself, are not aware of this. Like, we think ketamine, we think they're gonna get those hallucinations and,
yeah,
you know, those types of effects, and it becomes, you know, anxiety provoking for the physician who's never prescribed it, and also for the patient who may have heard about it or Googled it. You know, I was listening to a podcast the other day, and the advertisement was for at-home ketamine, and it was essentially you get a telemedicine visit with a psychiatrist and then they send it to your home. My concern is that the studies that I see and what I see online typically has a team approach or a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist involved for the systemic treatments. This is different than the mucosal treatments. So, we'll transition to talking about that because of the anxiety and the fear of death type of situations that we're using these medications for. But I kind of want to talk to you about that like collaborative approach and how you guys are managing it with that other organization that we talked about earlier.
Sure, sure. So just kind of as a jumping off point, I do want to say, from our earlier conversation, you were talking about how you this is something you just easily observe in your own practice that you don't necessarily need to study to know it. But you know, chronic pain is a different kind of disease from acute pain, and is highly highly associated with depression to the point where treating one can often give you some benefit in the other. And one of the things about novel antidepressant agents is that it even if they don't directly create a change in pain response, the alteration of perception of what pain is and what it represents to someone's daily lived experience can make a difference in terms of there's nociception on the one hand, which is the physical manifestation of pain signaling, and there's the subjective experience of pain, which is a different thing. And interventions aimed at mental distress, even if they don't affect the nociceptive pathway directly, they can induce a change in that subjective experience of pain, and that's powerful too. As a jumping off point, ketamine is one drug among a number of psychedelic agents where we are we're kind of at the beginning of what I think is going to be a golden age, or at least a rebirth of serious psychedelic research and finding a way to optimize the therapeutic benefits of psychedelic therapies for people who are dealing with intolerable and intractable mental distress. There's been excellent research out of Johns Hopkins. Matt Johnson, who actually once gave a grand rounds to us in residency, has been at the forefront of that. There are quite a few people who are doing it now. Psilocybin, derived from the mushroom, has shown a great deal of promise, specifically in the cancer population. And there are a number of other substances that have shown promise. MDMA has been studied in PTSD, as we were discussing. Ketamine's also been studied in the PTSD setting. I could be misquoting this, so somebody's going to look it up and find that I'm wrong, but I believe there was either a JAMA or an NEJM article recently about mescaline, which is the main psychoactive component of the peyote cactus. All of these drugs, with the exception of ketamine, are profound serotonergic agents. And what we're seeing is that they can overcome circumstances where conventional use of SSRIs, conventional use of other kinds of antidepressants are just not effective. These are patients who in the past might have been shunted to something like electroconvulsive therapy or some kind of radical neurosurgical approach isn't really done anymore.
Just to hop back for a sec, this has been in major journals. I mean, like JAMA had a study on psilocybin for major depressive disorder. It was a randomized controlled trials, and it was positive, and it showed that psilocybin had an effect on treating major. This is not like mild depression. This was major depression. And, there's been some discussion about, the way they did it, but it's a starting off point. And the effect size is larger than that we see with SSRIs with very limited side effects, because everybody gets an SSRI. It's like, oh, it messes with my sleep. It messes with my sex drive. It messes with this. And it's a long-term thing, something you got to take daily. And when you're depressed, maybe like taking a pill even every day is kind of a pain in the butt. But, these types of studies, like, they're finally happening. It may be worthwhile to discuss some of the historical reasons that it's just starting up again, rather than, in the heyday 50, 60 years ago. And you got to kind of give a great description of what happened politically and federally.
Sure. Let's talk about the history. I just do want to mention, so that I don't forget about it, in connection with what you're saying about the drawbacks of SSRIs. The other thing with these psychedelic agents is they work instantly. You don't have to wait a month or 2 months for them to kick in. And, probably the best way of doing it is as a series of infusions or what have you, with hopefully along with some kind of structured psychotherapy, because those things are synergistic. But, you know, going through, you know, a month or 2 months of dedicated psychedelic treatment can mean not needing to be on medications after that. And that's powerful, too. You know, again, in terms of the history, a lot of this stuff was originally synthesized back in the 40s, 50s, 60s. None of these are new drugs whatsoever. And of course, you know, quite a few of them have played a role in indigenous medicine, indigenous spiritual practices. They've been known about in one fashion or another for hundreds, thousands of years. There was a period back in the 60s and 70s when, you know, a lot of psychiatrists and researchers were looking into these things, finding profound mind-altering experiences and making promises about consciousness alteration and sort of elevating your mental and physical position in the world, and lots of revolutionary kind of dogma also. And without taking a position one way or another about the ideological and political valences there, this was an approach that, in addition to not being all that rigorously scientific, was doomed to engender a backlash and doomed to be something that is not going to see mainstream acceptance either by the medical community or the community of people with conditions at large who could benefit from these kinds of things. Now, I think that, again, without taking a position on the politics, the reaction to it and the regulation of these kinds of drugs was a severe overcorrection. And we have lost 30, 40, 50 years of potential progress, and all the people who've suffered kind of needlessly during that period with therapies that were less effective, you know, they've been the collateral damage of that interplay. But, you know, finally, the conditions are ripe for a restart. You know, somebody like Matt Johnson, as opposed to somebody like Timothy Leary saying, you know, tune in, turn on, drop out, that kind of thing.
Yeah, when you make it like something you do at a festival or a show, or like very woo woo, I think it makes people anxious. I mean, I would say, like, there's a time in my life where I'd be like, that's crazy. These people are crazy. And, you know, we're physicians. We're generally sort of conservative about these things. What would you say to a doctor that's a little bit closed-minded about this at this point in time?
You know, I'd say start with the science. I mean, I think that's where our training is based. Look at the research, look into the pharmacology, beginning at a basic level, see how these drugs work, how their operation is, how they function, and then start looking into some of the clinical research regarding it. And what you'll see is that, if you put to one side all of the noise, all the cultural connotations, all that other stuff, we are talking about medication that has shown extraordinarily promising therapeutic potential for people who are in a great deal of suffering. And our responsibility as physicians is to do what we can to alleviate that suffering. And we have a tool here that has been sorely underutilized that we should be exploring. And, you know, as to the conservatism, this is exactly why we need to be doing well-designed trials, careful, considerate research, so that we can be very comfortable talking to, you know, someone who's lived a conventional life in middle age, going through something. Almost everybody has periods of depression, different times in their lives, and it can often be really bad. If we can present, you know, this is the latest and greatest science. This is not about anything that happened, you know, back at Woodstock. This is not about going to music festivals. This is here's something that can take you from a situation where you are in a lot of distress, and we've tried things that are done conventionally and they're not working, and we actually have another alternative for you, and it's worth trying.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we are in a ripe era. You're right. And they're popping up everywhere. It's in the mainstream news now. You're seeing it all the time. There was a women's magazine. I think it was, it wasn't Vogue, but it was talking about Molly moms and how they were using it for their anxiety and postpartum depression. sharing their experiences with MDMA to help them cope through one of the most stressful periods in their life. Very different than cancer, but again, a huge quality of life issue. And here we are, so easy to write a prescription for Effexor for years and years for these people. And they're on them, and it may or may not work, and it may or may cause significant side effects. We do this for pain, and we write these prescriptions for opioids, and they get hooked on them. Sometimes it helps, sometimes it does more harm than good, but we're very comfortable with doing that. These newer agents are not used for consecutive days or consecutive weeks. The idea is to have an intentional approach of using it X number of times to reach an endpoint of some benefit to the patient. And I think that's what really fascinates me, to reset the mind, to be able to say like, hey, we want to help fix this, not just create a new pathway for a new medication to be used for an indefinite period of time. I mean, that kind of, that's conspiratorially, but it feeds into what pharma wants. And that's maybe something that's holding this back, is that no one's going to make billions off of this. I can't see that, at least.
No, I mean, maybe there's some opportunity to capture profit through volume, but you're certainly right. Something with the goal of getting people off of chronic medication puts the financial incentives in the wrong order for getting the kind of backing that conventional drugs might see. But, you know, as physicians, we should not care whatsoever about that. And in fact, we should be taking a role in advocating for our patients. And I'll give you another example. Right now, if somebody fails several lines of antidepressant medication, they might be put on an MAOI. And that means now for the rest of your life, you're severely curtailed in what you can safely eat. You know,
no cheese?
No cheese, as opposed to, you know, 4 weeks of, occasional psilocybin or MDMA infusions or whatever, and then you move on. Now, you know, you mentioned resetting things. There is a tendency to go back to set point, and I think this is important. So, you know, sometimes these things work for 6 months, 8 months, 18 months at a time, and then you might need to do another course. But again, that's a different circumstance than needing to adhere to a daily medical regimen with side effects, with, you know, sexual function problems that are associated with weight gain problems, just not eating, being able to eat the foods that you like. You know, you can get serotonin syndrome from SSRIs potentially. Those kinds of risks and dangers do not come into play when you're talking about something that's used either through one course or sporadically.
So for our listeners and for me, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Give me three clinical scenarios where an everyday practitioner like me can help a patient using a non-pharmacologic, non-opioid or non-traditional medicine to help our patients in multiple scenarios.
Well, you know, non-pharmacologic was one of the things that you mentioned. So, you know, I want to say I have referred patients of mine for dialectical behavior therapy, which is a kind of a psychotherapeutic modality, something I learned about in medical school and just developed a big interest in. It's an offshoot of cognitive behavioral therapy that incorporates certain spiritual practices and teaches core skills like distress tolerance, mindfulness, things of that nature. Puts a lot of emphasis on the creation of meaning as an active process that acts as a prophylactic against depression and anxiety. As an oncologist, if you know someone who is suffering with mental conditions, and let's say they don't want to opt for any kind of pharmacologic solution, getting them into an effective psychotherapeutic modality, having that, being able to have that conversation and make the referrals, that is something that anyone can do now, and something that we shouldn't be afraid to do. You know, you're not claiming to be a trained psychiatrist or someone who's an experienced psychotherapist, but having enough knowledge to know what questions to ask, how to speak to a patient and whom to refer to, that's powerful. Now, you know, in terms of pharmacologic interventions, there's two things here. Ketamine, because it's Schedule 3, is something that we can make referrals for now. So the other trial that we've kind of referenced obliquely a couple times is a pilot study that we're doing treating patients who've gone through a palliative prescription for radiation therapy with ketamine augmented psychotherapy, and that's been done in collaboration with a group called Field Trip Health. It's a private group that is made up of psychiatrists and psychologists who are trained in structured psychotherapy sessions to enhance and consolidate the effects of psychedelic therapy. And indeed, you talked about people getting ketamine prescriptions at home. If possible, it's really better to do it with a licensed mental health care practitioner who has specific training in this modality and can assist. These things are not cheap, unfortunately, if you're doing them on your own. You know, our patients, it's all paid for, but off trial, there is an expense associated with it. And that's a separate thing to deal with. But that's also something that's available right now.
So for this study, is there any availability for other centers to join or to start their own program? I mean, I think like you're setting up an infrastructure that has not been there in America. I mean, essentially, yeah. It's not been there. Like your work, I'm not saying you're the only person doing it. You're one of the only people doing it in our world. And I think, you know, people are interested. People talk about this. Like we're all talking about it offline. You know, this is really, really changing quickly, especially amongst younger docs. Younger docs are a lot more open to this. We don't really, I shouldn't say we, I'm no longer a young doc, but most of us don't even know how to get there. Like, how do we do this? You know, and we talked a little bit about it, about what we can bring to patients, but what do you say to other investigators, other people interested? I mean, how do they join you? How do we help?
So here's the thing is we have to be able to have conversations outside of radiation oncology and outside of oncology. Talk to psychiatrists, talk to neurologists. If you're in an academic center, they should be somewhere down the hall. You'd be stunned, I think, or a lot of people, I think, would be surprised. You just broach these conversations with psychiatrists, at least ones who are, you know, on the earlier side of their career and have, you know, maybe not completed training, you know, during the period where these things were shunned. People are not just open to it, but you start a conversation with a psychiatrist, and they'll be like, I'm fascinated by this stuff. I'm dying to do some research into it. How can we work together? And as cancer doctors, we are auspiciously placed because we're dealing with people who have so much of a mental distress burden that they and also just from a regulatory perspective, you know, being able to supply cancer patients with experimental unconventional treatments is just a hell of a lot easier than somebody who's not diagnosed with cancer. So we are actually really good conduits for getting people into a pathway towards these forms of unconventional therapy. You know more about this than I do. You don't have to be in an academic center. People in private practice are doing innovative, interesting, ambitious clinical trials. Sometimes there's less red tape. But you know, find the psychiatrists and the neurologists in your community who are interested in this stuff and want to work with you and work with them. You know, some of it is just, you know, having the energy and the initiative to get out and do it. I was able to start two trials with ketamine as a resident. So I think anybody can do it if they just want to.
Yeah. I mean, I'm seriously inspired. I'm going to call our local psychiatrist. We're in a small town. We don't have that many practitioners, but I think one, this is a beautiful thing to bring to patients, hopefully on some sort of study. That's how I would prefer it. But in general, at least the availability to have someone in the community to talk to intelligently about this, because the door shut fast on a lot of interesting ideas. To get back to where we started to circle the loop, I mean, when I started the low-dose radiation for arthritis, I got a couple of, like, not quite threatening, but I got some phone calls from the orthopedists. Yeah. And they would ask questions as if they were a patient, but we can see their name on the caller ID. And then like midway through, they would just hang up. And now, you know, they're sending patients because they've become open to the idea. And they know that there's too many arthritis patients for them to treat. Many of them don't want surgery. Many of them don't want to be on medications. And so we may provide a conduit, not a conduit, but a solution for them, at least in the short term. And this is very similar. Like we're going to get a little bit of resistance. We're going to get a little pushback. And then when people see that it can benefit patients, then everybody wants to join in. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I see for the next few years.
And here's the through line between low dose radiation for arthritis, functional radiosurgery, and dare I say it, psychedelic therapy for mental conditions is, it's an alternative to either chronic medication use or potentially morbid surgical intervention. It's something that can be effective, that can be done in a single session or in a short course of sessions, can be highly efficacious, is generally, at least according to the data that we have right now, non-toxic, well-tolerated, and gives people the opportunity, or the, at least a decent potential of what they really want, which is a solution to their problem that is durable, that doesn't require daily medication, and that doesn't force them to go under anesthesia and have themselves cut open.
Dan, this has been exceptional. I've learned a lot. I learned a lot talking to you earlier this morning. I learned a lot with this episode. Our listeners are going to love this. You are going to be on several times to tell me updates. Just thank you. Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
I'm thrilled to talk to you, thrilled to have the opportunity. I'll come back anytime you'll have me.